Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Our farmers, our families, our rural communities deserve the certainty of a five-year farm bill. There's no reason we can't do this.
On the floor of the Senate Thursday morning, Debbie Stabenow, chair of the Senate Ag Committee.
There's no reason that we can't do this. If we take the lessons of the past, if we creatively work together to meet the needs that we know need to be addressed as more and more volatility affects our farmers and ranchers across the country. We can do that. We can do that. And I'm committed to doing everything in my power, Mr. President, as chair of the Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry Committee to make that happen.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Yesterday, I announced the Rural Prosperity and Food Security Act.
She's the chair of the Senate Ag Committee from Michigan, Debbie Stabenow.
This is a serious bill that reflects bipartisan priorities to keep farmers farming, to keep families fed, and to keep rural communities strong. I hope those are values and priorities that we all share together. The foundation of every successful farm bill is built on a broad bipartisan coalition. That's how we get it done, as the Mr. President, as you know. We get it done because we bring everybody together. We don't put forward things that lose votes. We put forward things that gain votes so that we can do what we did in the last five-year farm bill, 2018, where we had 87 members of the United States Senate come together, which was extraordinary at that time, because we built the coalition, we respected each other, and we did not look for policies that would divide. So it's important that farmers and ranchers, rural communities, foresters, nutrition and hunger advocates, conservationists, bioenergy advocates, local governments, and climate advocates come together. That's a broad coalition, and so many more I could list on and on, that come together to be able to address a five-year bill that addresses rural America, our economy, feeding Americans, being there when they need some help, protecting our land and water and air resources that are so important, and investing in a rural quality of life, like where I grew up in northern Michigan in Clare. The Rural Prosperity and Food Security Act is a bill that holds the coalition together. Now, it is a bill that I put together with my Democratic colleagues on the committee, but it includes 100, actually over 100, bipartisan bills, over 100 bipartisan bills introduced this Congress through the hard work of Republicans and Democrats on the committee, as well as off the committee, and the input of a broad farm bill coalition. I would hope at this point I would be in a situation where we would be bringing forward a bipartisan bill, but we are not there yet. But it's my responsibility as the leader of the committee to put forward, I believe, is the vision and the policies that can get us there. And that's what this is talking about. There are many things in here. I will not go through all of them, Mr. President. There are too many. But I will say this. We are strengthening the important farm safety net by making meaningful investments that focus our tax dollars, our American resources, on American farmers with dirt under their fingernails, not billionaire Wall Street or foreign investors, who, by the way, we ban from receiving commodity payments in this bill. This bill makes support for beginning farmers a priority. We need more people that want to go into farming, either starting from scratch or going home to the family farm. We need them. We need the people being willing to do the critical work, and they need to be a priority, and they are a priority in this farm bill.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
You know, demand for sorghum remains really strong when you look at the market from a couple specific lenses here.
Patrick Wade is with the Texas Grain Sorghum Producers.
One of the things, of course, for us as an industry that we are most focused on and have been for the better part of the last decade is the availability and the robustness of the Chinese market for grain sorghum. This has effectively since 2013 or so, when we first saw sales really pick up for China, this has dictated not just the flow of sorghum, but a premium in prices, especially here on the export market, and particularly as we referenced, for those growers on the Texas Gulf Coast and in South Texas who are so proximate to the export locations that we see most of the sorghum in the U.S. go out of. So right now we're looking at, as of the most current numbers we've got from USDA, as of mid-April, we've seen about 200 million bushels total have been contracted to all of our various export markets around the world, and 94% of those have gone to China. Now, we saw last year during the previous 2022-2023 marketing year, due to drought and other challenges, you know, it was a relatively reduced crop that absolutely hit the jet boost when last summer came around and a good South Texas Gulf Coast crop came out. China bought it up right away. It hit the market and was loaded at those ports, whether it's Corpus Christi or Houston or Galveston in Texas, and gone around to China. Look, this remains our most consistent, our most relevant market. And, you know, it's one that's born out of, you know, a couple key factors, I think, that we really take pride in the work that's gone into sort of establishing those. First and foremost, you know, there remains a policy advantage that we have in the Chinese market, in the sense that there is no tariff rate quota for imports of grain sorghum like there is for corn and rice and wheat. So there's no competition within Chinese buyers to say, you know, you get allocated this level of grain that you can buy from the government, otherwise you hit a certain tariff. We're not subject to that in the sorghum market. That remains one of our greatest advantages, as well as the internal demand there. As the Chinese economy we've seen has continuing recently to grow leaps and bounds and sort of surpassing some growth targets. You know, pork consumption, baijiu, alcohol that is the most consumed spirit in the world, simply based on the Chinese population numbers, relies heavily on sorghum as one of its seven key ingredients. And we've seen U.S. sorghum sort of enter more into that role as opposed to domestic sorghum. And then, look, lastly, it's about relationships, and whether that's the relationships we've maintained with Chinese buyers and importers and end users there, even through challenging times like COVID or trade war disruptions that have led us to be, you know, remain very close to them, and sort of manifested in the sense that actually a U.S. sorghum trade team earlier this year was the first U.S. ag commodity group to go on a trade mission to China since COVID. And we take pride in that being the sort of result of a lot of good relationship building there.
And the crop year usually is defined in South Texas.
You know, we're maybe a month, maybe a little bit more than a month out from really seeing harvest pick up. And there's just a lot of anticipation for the first time in a couple of years, you know, a really tremendous crop down there. We've come close to it before, and certainly last year, you know, we saw a good South Texas and Gulf Coastal crop kind of rescue what had been a really challenging year for the sorghum industry, especially here in Texas. But right now, like, there's a lot of optimism that we're going to see a real bumper crop this year down there.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I think it creates, for me as the Secretary of Agriculture and for all of you, a sacred responsibility focused on conserving.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
First of all, conserving those natural resources, and that's why it's important for us to continue to work collaboratively together in partnership to utilize the resources that are now available under the Inflation Reduction Act that expand dramatically the amount of resource and support for conservation. And I know that farmers and ranchers and producers are taking advantage of this because the programs are oversubscribed. The demand is great. We want to continue to work to use those resources in a way that allows you to enrich the soil, to improve water quality, to conserve those resources. I think it's important and a sacred responsibility on our part to ensure that we conserve the opportunity to continue to farm, notwithstanding the fact that farmers, ranchers, and producers across the country are often faced with disasters. We know that we've seen a marked increase in the intensity of those disasters. The 100-year flood doesn't occur every 100 years. Unfortunately and tragically, in some parts of the country, they occur 100 days apart. And so it's important for us to continue to focus on risk management, on crop insurance, to ensure that we, in fact, can provide the assistance and help.
And speaking of natural resources, rural communities.
On my desk, there's also a book that was written in 1863. It was the first report of the Commissioner of Agriculture for the United States. It was a report to Abraham Lincoln. Thankfully, I don't have to do that with President Biden. Good Lord. This report was 632 pages long. It was remarkable. But in it was a preface about the importance of preserving the opportunity for small and mid-sized farming operations as central to our democracy, and a warning that if we allow the erosion of small and mid-sized operations, that our democracy, our country, would suffer. Fast forward to 1981, a predecessor of mine, Secretary Berglund from Minnesota, expressed the same concern. As we watched the transition from a supply management system where farmers did pretty well during the post-Depression era to a supply management, to a market system, the concern was that this would drive further consolidation of farmland. Since 1981, since Bob Berglund issued that warning, we've lost 437,300 farms. Now, that's farm families that are no longer in the farming business, which means that in all likelihood their families are no longer in those small communities, which means their children aren't in school, which is one of the reasons why schools have had to consolidate. They're not shopping at the central business district, which means that small family-owned business may not be in business today. It may be a dollar store or Walmart. It means that the local hospital maybe is now a clinic. And the question I ask all of you today is whether we're okay with that. In a 40-year period, the loss of that many farms, to give you a sense of how many farmers that is, that's every farmer today in North Dakota and South Dakota, in Wisconsin and Minnesota, in Iowa and Illinois, Nebraska and Colorado. At the same time, since 1981, we've lost 141 million acres of farmland, land that was once in farming that isn't farming today. That's the landmass of Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and Maryland. Are we okay with that?
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Our bill will provide farmers and ranchers with more choices that provide timely and flexible assistance that meets their needs.
Chairwoman of the Senate Ag Committee for Michigan, Debbie Stabenow.
Lower cost crop insurance, a more effective commodity title, more opportunities for affordable credit to operate the farm as input costs go up. And the list goes on and on. We importantly permanently authorize the Agriculture Disaster Assistance Program, which unfortunately is having to be used more and more and more. And I want that to be clear, that that's a permanent part of agriculture policy. And this bill makes it a priority to help our farmers and ranchers address the emerging risks that we know they all face. We also ensure that farmers are planting to meet market demand, not to receive a government payment. We made major reforms in the 2014 bill to emphasize that, and then again in 2018, and it's important to keep it going. Farming has always been one of the riskiest ways to make a living. I've said it's the riskiest business around. Nobody else has to monitor the weather all day and night to figure out what's going on as to whether or not their business is going to be okay. Conservation programs are a vital part of our risk management for farmers today. I'm proud that they are voluntary, that they are popular, that they are used, that farmers think they make a difference, and it's important that we continue to invest and protect those dollars. This bill builds on our historic investment in those popular voluntary conservation programs by making the title the conservation title, a permanent investment, a permanent part of the farm bill, permanent authorization, and we invest to make sure we are confronting the climate crisis today and in the future by taking the dollars that we have allocated for climate smart agriculture, putting it into the farm bill and supporting these important voluntary climate smart efforts. This will put resources into farmers' pockets to continue the practices they are already doing and that they want to do more of on the farm and the ranches around the country. And while the farm bill is the backbone of the farm safety net, it's also the backbone of the family safety net through our nutrition title. And I want to thank our subcommittee chair, who's presiding now, who chairs our subcommittee on nutrition, for your leadership. Thank you very much. The Rural Prosperity and Food Security Act reflects our shared belief, Republicans and Democrats, that no American parent should have to worry about whether or not they will be able to feed their children. No American senior should have to choose between buying food and paying for their medications. No American service member should experience hunger while serving their country. This bill will help millions of hardworking Americans make ends meet in a time when they really need it, a time of crisis, by continuing the five-year update to the SNAP Thrifty Food Plan, included in the bipartisan 2018 Farm Bill, to ensure that SNAP reflects the realities of how Americans buy food and prepare food.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The newly finalized EID, Electronic Identification Rule, from USDA is really more of an update to the 2013 Animal Disease Traceability Rule.
Ethan Lane is with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
That is the rule that established requirements for sexually intact cattle over 18 months, basically breeding stock, moving interstate, as well as rodeo cattle, bison, and dairy cattle, requiring those classes of cattle and no other classes to have an official ID tag in order to cross state lines. So over the last 11 years, that has typically come in the form of a bright tag, a metal ear tag. But this rule updates that requirement. And moving forward, starting 6 months from the finalization of this rule, which would be about November 1st of this year, the requirement for that class of cattle to move interstate will be what they're calling a visually or electronically readable, visually and electronically readable ID tag. So an 840 tag is the best example of that. So that will be the new requirement. The class of cattle for beef cattle remains the same. The general structure of that program remains the same. This is effectively an upgrade in the technology or a change in the technology that's being used. And critically, what they've done here is switch from years of the industry and USDA and others talking about RFID tags, radio frequency ID tags, to EID. And they say in this final rule that the reason for that is to make note of the fact that technology continues to evolve, and they don't believe RFID is the final word here in what will be an effective technology. You know, clearly anyone who's worked on this issue knows that high frequency works in some places and not in others, and the same for low frequency. There are all kinds of issues with that technology, and USDA is sort of presuming in this rule that the marketplace is going to have some additional solutions out there in the years to come. Nevertheless, that is kind of the structure of what we're looking at, and that rule will go into effect November 1st for producers around the country. In the meantime, they will be able to use those metal tags to put those breeding stock into compliance and basically grandfather themselves in under the old system, should they wish to do that. But after that 6 month date in the fall, they will have to use that new form of ID for cattle that are meeting that description and moving interstate.
He says cattlemen and the industry have been debating this for years.
What we've done over the last 10 or 15 years is have a kind of an evolving policy on this, driven by our members, that puts forth what we as an industry believe we would like to see in a nationally significant traceability program. Now, that stays silent on whether we're talking about a government program or an industry-driven solution, but in those in those tenets, what we say is that our preference is for the industry to be in the driver's seat on the program. Our preference is for the program to not place the financial burden for compliance on our producers. The preference is for that program to move at the speed of commerce, to protect our producers' data, to make sure that it isn't used inappropriately or fall into the wrong hands. So, you know, there's been kind of an evolution over the years of what the industry can agree a successful program might look like, but you're never going to craft something that's going to make everybody happy here. The goal is to be as inclusive as we can and looking at those different perspectives, and follow our members' lead in where they go with this. And that's a policy they've put forward. So given that, we certainly can support, the tenets of what USDA is doing here. Although it certainly can be noted that I think the preference of our industry is for a producer-led, a voluntary solution. But we did pass policy in Orlando that recognizes that we do recognize the need and the importance of what USDA is doing here on this class of cattle moving forward.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I don't think the country can stand a continued acceleration of the loss of small and mid-sized farming operations. We can do better.
Earlier this year, Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack on sustainability programs and opportunity.
We can figure out ways in which large production agriculture can continue to flourish, as it is important and necessary to meet the food demands not just of the U.S., but of the world. But at the same time, we can also provide an entrepreneurial opportunity for that small and mid-sized operation. What am I talking about? Well, Zippy mentioned the sustainability practices that Farm Bureau and a number of farm organizations came to USDA and suggested that if we could set up a voluntary, incentive-based, market-driven system, farmers would respond. And boy, was he right about that. Now, 141 projects are now engaged in 50 states involving well over 100 major commodities, involving 205 sustainability practices. Farmers are now going to be paid, encouraged, incented, rewarded for taking those steps to be more sustainable. And we're going to work with the market forces to create a value-added opportunity. But the great opportunity in the sustainable area isn't just a value-added opportunity, isn't just farmers being rewarded for being good stewards of the land. It's also the ability to measure and monitor and verify the results of those practices and be able to utilize them in creating market opportunities through carbon markets and other environmental markets that are designed for farmers, creating a whole new source of income for farming operations. At the same time, there are projects like GEVO, which is operating out of the upper Midwest, that is focused on taking agricultural waste and turning it into sustainable aviation fuel. This is a whole new opportunity for American agriculture to embrace our transportation challenges. While we're getting to net zero, we're going to help the transportation industry get to net zero. It's a 36-billion-gallon industry that doesn't exist today, that can create nearly 1 million jobs in rural places, that can create more opportunity, more sustainable economic opportunity for small and mid-sized operations.
He also talked about the reduced input cost through investment.
We're excited about this future. We're excited about lowering costs for farmers. We know that input costs are a deep concern. That's why we continue to see an expansion of our Renewable Energy for America program, helping individual farming operations lower their energy costs by installing on their farm individualized renewable energy projects. Today, we're announcing an expansion of opportunity in that space. Excited about that opportunity. We're announcing 650 additional projects being awarded in 42 states, about $150 million to expand that opportunity. It's going to help lower costs for farmers all across the United States. We've already done over 4,800 of those awards, and we're going to continue to see a significant increase. But it's not just lowering the cost that this creates. It also creates the opportunity as farmers improve renewable energy opportunities and increase the amount of energy that's produced on their farm. They can take that excess energy and, working with their neighbors, potentially work with their REC to create power purchasing agreements and yet another income source that doesn't exist today that will exist in the future.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
An increase in what livestock producers received price-wise for their commodities in March resulted in a month-over-month rise in the total agricultural price index per USDA's latest look released earlier this week. The 2.3% rise in the livestock price received index from February was attributed to an over 5% gain in what meat animal producers received as prices for their products. While a slight uptick price-wise occurred for prices received by dairy growers, that was offset by a 0.5% decrease in what poultry and egg producers received for prices in March. The 1.5% month-over-month increase in prices received total also included a lower crop production index, down 1.2% from February. Most categories in the crop production index were down slightly from the previous month, with the exception of vegetables and melons, up 0.1% in March. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.